This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website, thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can listen to live shows or to our past shows on iPod Ready Archives. And the site is thepeoplespeakradio.net. And if you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen live via satellite. So just go to the website for details on how to do that. Tonight we have with us Mike Farrell. It is an honor to have him back with us again. He is best known for his 8 years on MASH and his 5 seasons on Providence. He's also a writer, director, and producer. Mike is a very outspoken and active citizen and has served on many human rights and peace delegations in countries all around the world. His first book, Just Call Me Mike, was a Los Angeles Times bestseller. He is a promoter of human rights and opposes the death penalty. These two areas are of prime concern to Mike, but there's so much more to the making of this man in his life that I could talk literally for an hour just about that. So right now it's my pleasure to introduce Mike Farrell to The People Speak. Hello, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you. Thanks very much for having me back.
Well, it's a pleasure. It really is. For those that have not heard of the newest book, the name and title is kind of strange to some. And it was interesting to me. It was certainly intriguing. And the name of the book is Of Mule and Man. For those that, you know, and you had to learn to, Mule, could you please explain to our listeners why you named it Mule?
Sure.
First of all.
For those who are familiar with Steinbeck's work, Travels with Charlie, Mule was my Charlie. Mule is a Prius, a hybrid automobile that my publisher rented for me to take a trip literally around the country, 9,000 miles in 5 weeks, to promote the paperback version of the first book you mentioned, Just Call Me Mike. Because of the gas crunch, I said, if you're going to put me in a car, and I'm happy to take a drive around the country, but if you're going to put me in a car, you better get me a hybrid because we're going to need to conserve gasoline. And for those who haven't had the experience, learning to drive a hybrid is a bit of a challenge, I found. I'm a guy who likes to shift gears and work the clutch and do all that stuff. And learning to drive this car was kind of a hoot. But I about the second day out, I decided that I said to the car, you are a cantankerous beast, and you are a hybrid. Mules are cantankerous beasts, and they are hybrids. So from now on, you are the mule. And the journal I wrote of the trip is essentially what the book is. And it's about falling in love with and having conversations with this beast, and it's about being in various parts of this country and meeting and seeing people and organizations that I've worked with over time and talking about the book and talking about things I saw on the road and things that happened and things I heard on the radio and what have you.
Well, I have to tell you, and I'm going to read the last paragraph of the acknowledgments, and it says, and he's acknowledging many of the people that have helped him in the book. And then he said, and the other is the sweet, irascible, shy, pushy, obedient, demanding, uncomplaining, touchy, indefatigable, fierce, valiant entity that stormed into my heart as it kept me safe, sane, warm, dry, and protected against whatever the gods chose to throw our way. But for Mule, this book would not exist. So you developed an incredible relationship with Mule, And we will refer to him to the car as Mule.
Thank you.
But the bells and whistles had you both impressed and pretty much on the edge of your seat a lot of the time, didn't they? According to everything that I was.
For those people who have driven these cars, it's, you know, it's not a new thing, I guess. But for me, having bells go off and having lights flashing on the dashboard and having all these sound effects when something was going wrong terrified me. I thought a couple times the car was going to explode or that there was a bomb going off somewhere, or I couldn't tell what was happening.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't have a GPS in my car, but I've been driven with friends that do, and every once in a while when this GPS starts to speak to me, I'm telling you, every single time I just jump right out of my seat. It's like, who is that?
I don't know if
I'll ever get used to cars talking back. That's, you know, I couldn't wait to get rid of the kids that talk back, let alone the cars that talk back. But it is definitely an interesting concept. One of the things that really touched me was the fact that you considered the connection between the mule being a hybrid and the car being a hybrid. Mm-hmm. For me, one of the greatest lessons, Mike, that I've learned in my life is it is what it is, not what I want it to be.
Well said, yeah.
And yeah, when sometimes. You finally, you were saying in the book how you, you know, when you saw that it was a hybrid and not a regular car, you suddenly did a lot better with it. And
Indeed. Isn't
that true for everything in life?
Oh, I think that's right. It's an interesting point to make. Accepting things as they are rather than as you want them to be is probably a major step toward not wearing yourself out trying to change things.
Well, not only that, but I think that if you can't see life as it is, and this is one of the lessons that as an activist I have learned. I started out by wanting to change the world, but I wasn't really realistic about how the world was in the first place. I really had a hard time accepting the world as it was, and it took me many years to overcome that. And I think there comes a point that unless you can accept the reality of what is, you can't really go ahead and change anything or even attempt to change anything because you're still living in that illusion.
Well, okay, yeah. When I made mention of the fact that you don't waste your energy trying to change things, I certainly didn't mean that I don't try to change things, but people, and I have a tendency to objectify things, give things, what do they call it, but give them sort of characteristics, not necessarily human characteristics, but characteristics of living things to which I can relate. And when I relate to living things as they are rather than as I want them to be, I find I do better.
Well, absolutely. The other part of it, I guess, is always what else would we be doing? We have to learn to – we have to actually love the struggle, I think, in order to be activists. Because if we actually based our what we have done to implement change in the world, it's really hard to measure those kinds of things, but
sure.
You know, what else would we be doing? You know, in the beginning of the book, you talked about how your lovely wife, Shelley Ferret Bray, who is, I'll be quite honest with you, and this is just not because Shelley Ferret Bray and you and MASH and all of the older shows like that, I think were the last genre of shows that were the predecessors of this reality storm TV that's come up, this sensationalist media storm, all of this unrealistic very sensationalist style television that we're witnessing. And, you know, when I look back at Shelley and her work and your work and the work of the period, it was a really refreshing comedy. It was just plain old comedy, and you had a lot of laughs and a lot of fun, and you related to the people to a certain extent. I mean, yeah, sure, there was a little bit of straying from a particular norm, but today you don't have that. I don't watch TV anymore. You know that, don't you?
Well, I don't watch it either. And you know,
there's
I
nothing there.
Yeah, no, that's quite right. The days of entertaining and enlightening people, which I think we did on MASH, seem to be long gone. Most of television is so exploitive and so ugly and so kind of brutalizing for the people that watch it. I think it troubles me a lot.
Well, you know what I found though too, but my position was that Shelley was not able to make it on your trip, and I think the fact that this book is almost like a diary. May I ask, did you somehow want to share this journey with your wife because she couldn't be with you? Was that
part of
the?
Of course, I did. I sent home every day's recording was immediately sent home to Shelley so she could be. On that level, be part of the trip, but you know, it's odd how things happen. She was intending and was intended to be part of the trip with me. She would have been my navigator and my partner, and you know, we'd have had a lot of fun together. And when she fell and hurt herself, it wasn't. It just simply wasn't possible, nor was it possible in good faith to change the cancel the trip. So I went, but you know, I think we both realized that had she been with me. Much of the, well, certainly the book wouldn't have happened, and much of the energy around the trip, which was the experience of getting to develop a relationship with the mule, probably wouldn't have happened. So, you know, things happen, I guess, for a reason. I don't mean to say that Shelley fell and hurt herself for a reason, but that, you know, changes happen and you deal with them as best you can.
Exactly. Certainly the dynamics change. Many of the groups, Death Penalty Focus, the ACLU, Greenpeace, Human Rights Watch, and a lot of the others were actually the co-sponsors for most of your book signings, were they not?
Yes, every place I stopped, there was a co-sponsorship with one of the human rights or social justice organizations I worked with over time.
And I really liked in the book how you added the little inserts in the middle of the pages.
That was
wonderful.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Yes,
that was a wonderful touch.
Well, it was terrific to be able to give, you know, an opportunity for some of these groups to get just a little more understanding of who they are and what they do.
Exactly, and that was excellent the way it was done. I just thought, wow, if more people could do that. Because I'm afraid, unfortunately, a lot of people don't know about many of these issues. And I think we live right now in probably one of the most enlightened times of our life. But I'm stunned and amazed as I go through life how little people know. They only know a little bit of the surface of what's really happening. I'd like to discuss with you one of the key issues that you're closely attached to with the death penalty. And part of the issues that you have with the death penalty is that often DNA evidence has proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that innocent people are being legally murdered by the state. Recently, in an interview with Angela Davis, one of her book titles asked the question, "Are prisons obsolete?" Mm-hmm. Well, I believe that they are. What do you think about that?
Oh, sure. You know, I think an old friend of mine many years ago in a conversation said we really should do away with prisons and replace them with what he called skull hospitals. Which would be a combination school and hospital, you know, so that people who are who are prone or as a result of whatever kind of problems they've had in their lives act out violently or act out inappropriately in society could be taken to a place where they would learn who they are, what their situation is, you know, mend the problems they have, and teach them the things that they haven't yet learned about how to get along in society. We have just given up any sense of rehabilitation in this society of ours. And as a result, our prisons are really just animal factories where people are brutalized and become worse human beings when they come out than they were when they went in.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and the statistics prove that. I mean, beyond a shadow of a doubt. Look at our prison system is now elevated in position and stature in the world to be we have more people incarcerated than any other country in the world. So obviously what we're doing is not working.
Well, no, that's quite right. We have more per capita and more in a percentage of our population in prisons than any other country in the world. And the prisons, in many instances, are worse. Our prisons are worse than the prisons in most of the other developed nations.
And the death penalty, the issue of DNA. How do you think that stands? I believe that right now we're seeing a lot of extremism when it comes to this kind of issues like the death penalty. I think people either don't want it at all or they want a lot more of it.
Well, I'm on the side of those who don't want it at all. I think the death penalty serves no real social purpose. It really does harm to us as a society. We're the only advanced Western nation that continues to use it. All others have given it up. We're one of the only two or three advanced nations in the world who continue to use it. And we're in the minority today, where there are 135 nations that have either ended the use of the death penalty or effectively have it on the books but don't use it. And we are one of some, I think it's 50 or 60, that continue to have it on the books and occasionally use it. We use it more than, we're in the top, I think, three or four in the world in terms of use of the death penalty. And it's really, I believe it does us harm emotionally and morally, but I also believe it's doing us harm in terms of our standing in the world.
Well, you know, Mike, I try to present questions sometimes later on, but some of the questions are pertinent to the particular topic. So I'd like to present a question from Lance in California, who asks, how many states in the USA still have the death penalty, and why do you think the USA still allows such a barbaric punishment?
35 states still have the death penalty, although not all of them use it. It was 37 and 13 that did not have the death penalty, but in the last couple of years, both New Jersey and New Mexico have given it up through legislative action. And a number of other states are now looking at giving it up for a reason that I'm frankly not too comfortable with, but I'm glad they're giving it up or thinking about giving it up for whatever the reason. People are finding that it is far more expensive to keep and use the death penalty than it is to eliminate it and have life without parole or permanent imprisonment be the ultimate punishment. As far as why the people of the United States or the United States, the 35 of the 50 states still use it and the federal government still has it and uses it, in my view, the reason is very simple. It's political cowardice. I think everybody understands that the system is racist, that it's only used against the poor, that it's rife with ethical problems, with corruption, that there isn't really an even playing field. The defense really does not have the same kind of tools available to it that the prosecution does. So there's always a kind of overwhelm in terms of facing up against the resources of the state. And people make mistakes, even when there's not corruption. People are human beings, and they make errors, and some of them have resulted in innocent people being put to death. Certainly, a great number of innocent people have been put to death row. We know of 135 people in the modern era who have been tried and convicted and sentenced to death and spent many years in prison and ultimately been found to have been wrongly convicted and have been exonerated and freed. But what we don't know is how many have who were innocent have not been seen or acknowledged to have their be innocent and have been executed. We know of a significant number of them, but we can't prove it because states don't want to admit to having made an error like that, so they don't usually make information available about the possibility of having killed an innocent person.
Well, I tell you, you certainly made, when you said that, that a lot of people are changing their tune due to the cost factor, that puts a new twist on the cheaper to keeper kind of mentality,
yep.
Doesn't it? That is
it does.
Just, yeah. You know, and like you said, you hate the reason, but as long as they're doing whatever it is.
Well, true, yeah. It used to, you know, it's counterintuitive. It's tough for some people to understand that it's cheaper to keep people in prison for the rest of their natural lives and feed them and maintain them there than it is to simply kill them. But there is no such thing as simply killing them. We have a constitution in this country, and that constitution requires that people have certain safeguards in a case that's been made against them where they are accused of something that could cost them their lives. And those safeguards become enormously time-consuming and expensive, so that it turns out that to put somebody through the process of the death process, the trial, appeals, execution, etc., costs about three times as much as it does to simply put somebody through a simple trial for life without parole and keep that person in prison for an average of 40 years, which is, I guess, the average of time somebody would spend in prison for his rest of his life.
Well, there goes back to the old adage, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Obviously, it's not working, and yet we're struggling with changing it. So
sure, Well, that's what I say. It really goes back to political cowardice. Politicians are afraid of being accused of being soft on crime. That being the case, they are turning a deaf ear and a blind eye to the whole issue of what's wrong with the death penalty, and they just simply continue to insist that it's fair and that it's safe and that it is fairly administered and that it is a deterrent, all of which have been demonstrated conclusively to be untrue.
We have another pertinent question to the death penalty issue from Henry in Wisconsin. Henry asks, what, if any, was the personal reason Mike became involved in his efforts against the death penalty? Did he know someone who was wrongfully convicted?
Not initially. I've always thought the death penalty made no sense, and I guess in the 70s I probably put my name on a petition or something. In 72, the death penalty was held unconstitutional, and in 76, it was reinstated. And I was doing MASH at the time, and I was contacted by a minister from the South who ran an organization opposing the death penalty, and he contacted me and asked if I would help him, because being the star of a very popular show made my ability to gain the attention of the media something that he was not able to do. So I went down. He was in Tennessee, and I went down to Tennessee and went with him to the Tennessee State Prison. It was the first death row I'd ever been on, and began to work with him. And subsequent to that time, of course, I've been involved in many cases in many states and all parts of the country, and have come to know people who had been on death row, many of whom were exonerated. I've been involved in cases where people actually were executed, much to my dismay, but involved in some cases where we were able to get people not off, well, in some cases we were able to get them off death row, and some cases get them out of prison, but certainly off death row. So I have become it's hard to use the word, because I'm not a hater, but I've come to hate the death penalty because of what I've seen it do to people, ruining lives, ruining people's psyche, even people on the other side, and people who were wardens in prisons and people who were parts of the death squads who actually strapped people into the electric chair or onto the gurney, and I've seen the harm that has come from the use of this system, and I really despise it for what it's done to so many people.
It's certainly a stunningly amazing situation where the state sanctions murder. But that's what it is, unfortunately. I'm very happy to live in Michigan, where we do not, where we voted against the death penalty, and I'm very proud of that.
Well, as well you should be. And your caller who asked the question is from Wisconsin, which is another state that does not have a death penalty.
All right. See, now there we go. Now we know where to live. Mike, you're deeply involved in a lot of the organizations, such as I said, Death Penalty Focus, Greenpeace, Human Rights Watch, many of the others. And like many Hollywood celebrities, it's a very important role. But I think that in your case, it's it's even more important, and I'll tell you why, because instead of all these honorary roles in these organizations, you actively participate in a majority of them and in many of the events that they promote. So that's huge. Do you think a lot of the other Hollywood celebrities do all that they can in these areas, or are they just a face?
Well, you know, that's a tough question. Hollywood is a community just like any other, and it has people of all stripes politically and all stripes mentally, and, you know, people who are pretty stupid and people who are very smart. But I know some really wonderful people who are very, very committed, some of them not so public about it for reasons that really don't need to be gone into. But, you know, I see the work that somebody like Brad Pitt did down in the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans after Katrina, and I see the work that people like Ed Begley Jr. do for the environment, and Jackson Brown and Bonnie Raitt do for so many good causes, including the environment. And I'm honored to be associated with those people. Harry Belafonte and Danny Glover are friends of mine, and we've worked together in many different areas. So there are great, really good folks in the industry who are very decent and committed citizens who care a lot and are actively out there. And there are others who, as you suggest, just sort of lend their names to some things because they think it's of value to have their names on the masthead of a certain organization, with which I don't disagree. If it's an organization whose work you support, I think it's fine to let them use your name. And I suppose there are some who add, who get involved in an issue or get involved with an organization just because they think it's going to be helpful to them rather than to the organization. And that's sad to see, but as I say, there are all kinds of people in this business.
There certainly are. You know, one of the things that, you know, when you and I talk about our positions and our beliefs, it's kind of easy, Mike, because I find that you and I basically agree, are on the same page as far as most of our political and humanitarian beliefs. But one of the most wonderful things that you do, and this is one of the things that you did as you traveled around the country, was you go directly to the horse's mouth, so to speak, and no offense to mule, because when I bring Rush Limbaugh into the topic and there, you know, that's like, the mule, it has nothing to do against your better half. but you literally challenge and speak to the conservative opposition, which on many, and you do it on talk radio and local broadcast networks. First of all, let me ask you, Mike, Rush Limbaugh, tell me why, after his fiasco with the OxyContin incident, is even considered a source of credibility in today's conservative arena? I mean, seriously, can't they come up with anybody else?
Well, you know, it's tough to know, but he gets a huge audience, and I say huge, relatively speaking. In radio, his audience is huge. I find him to be contemptible. I don't in any way apologize for or even agree to, although he's never asked me, but I would never agree to do an interview with Rush Limbaugh because I think he's really truly contemptible. I have been on Sean Hannity's show a number of times and actually have made some headway with Sean in recent months, I think. But, you know, these guys, I think, it's hard to know who's really sincere and who's not, but I think that they, on some level, excuse what they do by telling themselves and other people that they're really entertainers and not serious, certainly not serious journalists, but not even not serious commentators. They're just kind of people who are trying to whip up the antagonism of people for their own sort of jollies. And when you see something happen like happened to Dr. Tiller as a result of the horror that was the horrifying words that were aimed at him by Bill O'Reilly and other people, it's not funny. It's not entertainment. It's a kind of exploitive viciousness that I simply have a difficult time understanding.
And I certainly agree with you, and I think that's the key. I agree. I believe Rush Limbaugh is perfectly contemptible. Hannity, on the other hand, I think maybe even worse, because I think he's more of a brown noser. I think he just is doing this to get kudos in with his company and where he works. Honestly, I find him to be completely disingenuous. But that's my opinion, I guess. But, you know, again, you go to the horse's mouth, you argue with these people. Do you believe, in some cases, you are making any headway? Or have there been hallmark moments where you found that you've influenced their mindset or their positions? Or are people just repeating the same things over and over again with no context?
Mostly, they repeat the same things over and over again, but I have to tell you, I did Sean Hannity's show in January of this year, and the first thing he said to me, both off the air and on the air, is, Mike, I've got to tell you, you have changed my mind. I now oppose the use of the death penalty.
Oh.
And when he said it on the air, I thanked him, and I said, Sean, you know, while we don't agree on many things, you are an opinion molder to a certain audience, and it's important to that audience to hear you say that the death penalty makes no sense. So I appreciate your being, you know, that forthright about it. As you say, you know, Sean and I used to beat each other up about the war in Iraq and any number of things. But the thing that makes me consider going back when I get invited on Sean's show or even O'Reilly's show, and some of these others, is the fact that every once in a while I hear from somebody, whether it's by email or by mail or in some other way, and they say, you know, I never thought of it. I appreciate the fact that you came on that show and I heard what you had to say, and I never thought about the issue that way, and I appreciate the fact that you dealt with it straightforwardly, you didn't end up into a shouting match, and you didn't use a lot of personal vindictive. You just were straightforward in your presentation of your beliefs, and that has made me think about X issue, whatever it is. So I find myself kind of in a quandary about it sometimes. I think, you know, I don't want to grace these guys with my presence. On the other hand, if there's somebody in the audience who can be moved by some of the things I have to say or some of the experiences I can tell about, then maybe there's some value in it.
Stan in Oregon wants to ask, and, you know, again, going back to the death penalty, which is very important to many people, apparently, around the country, what is your opinion of George Bush after he refused to commute the execution of Carla Faye Tucker in Texas?
Well, my opinion of George Bush is well known. I find the man despicable. But, you know, he up until Mr. Perry took over in Texas, George Bush was the governor who had been responsible for the execution of more people than any other in the country. Now, mm-hmm. Rick Perry has become the killer of more than George Bush did. But Carla Faye Tucker's case was an extraordinary one. Most people probably are familiar with the name, most of your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a woman who had committed a terrible, terrible crime and understood that it was a terrible crime and tried to do penance for it and went through a very serious religious conversion, which is the source of, I suppose, suspicion for a lot of people when somebody's in prison. But she was sincere to the degree that both, as I understand it, both Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, again, for whom I have no great deal of respect, but they speak for a lot of people in the area, or in Falwell's case, spoke for a lot of people in the area of religion, endorsed her call for a commutation of her sentence to life without parole and just don't kill her. Bush ignored them and allowed her to be dead, and not only did he allow her to be executed, he mocked her in an interview with a reporter, mocked her plea for mercy. And that's the act of a coward, and I find the man beneath contempt.
We have a gentleman that is, this is Cyber Hiker Scott in South Carolina. Mike, doesn't it make you sick to your stomach to sit here and talk about Rush Limbaugh when you have such disgusting actors that constantly run their mouth, like this idiot Sean Penn and Alec Baldwin?
I'm not quite sure I get the comparison. I know both Sean and Alec very well, and I find them to be not idiotic at all. I find them to be quite extraordinarily intelligent people who don't just run their mouths, but in fact are very informed about the issues to which they speak.
Well, thank you. I would hope that they would be, because both of them are some of my favorites. We're going to be taking a break for just a couple of minutes here, folks, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes with actor and writer extraordinaire Mike Farrell.
Join the World March for Peace and Nonviolence, an international three-month event spanning seven continents and over 1 million participants. With endorsements from luminaries worldwide such as President Jimmy Carter, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The World March for Peace and Nonviolence seeks to bring attention to the need to end war and occupation, reduce arms spending, and all forms of violence. Please visit theworldmarch.org.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
In our Constitution, the Founding Fathers laid a path to an economy that should have kept Americans free and prosperous. How we the people were tricked off that path into a world of debt and deception reads like one of the great mystery novels of all time. American Free Press compares author Ellen Brown's new book, Web of Debt, to an eye-opening thriller that will leave you feeling like Neo in the Matrix. In Web of Debt, the mysterious and often shocking origins of today's ultimate financial crisis are exposed, starting with its distant beginnings to its present disastrous climax, as the reader is shown that the way to restore America's true wealth has been with us all along. Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, to see how America's money and future can become by and for the people once again.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show. Our guest tonight is Mike Farrell with his new book of Mule and Man. Hello, Mike. Thank you for being with us again.
My pleasure.
I believe we have a caller, Alan, on the line. Alan, do you have a question for Mike Farrell?
You'll have to speak up, Alan.
Okay.
Oh, there you are.
I am here.
What's up?
Oh, well, I wanted to know, with the national recidivism rate being about 87%, do you attribute this to prison's intentional suppression of serious rehabilitation efforts?
Sure.
I mean, it's like 87 out of 100.
That was a little bit too pat for you, Alan.
I know.
I think he was hoping for a little bit more, Mike.
Well, you asked a simple question. Of course, it's a result of the way in which people are treated when they're in prison. If you have people who are bent, broken, in pain, in need, going into who act out in society, and you put them in prison and do nothing about the problems they have, excuse me, then of course what you're going to do is create somebody who's going to go back out and do the same things, and that's the nature of recidivism.
Yes, I understand that. Just to give you some hope, in 1992, I walked out of the gates of prison after doing 7 years, and I have never returned.
Good
and
for
I do
you.
Believe that rehabilitation is an effort that one has to make themselves. A lot of guys in there, they do not want to rehabilitate once they're there.
You know, I was part of a program many years ago that was a halfway house style program. And one of the fellows, one of the men who ran it, was a years-long drug addict and alcoholic and had real serious problems and was in and out of jails and got his life together on his own, as you suggest you have, for which I commend you. But he said an interesting thing when somebody said something about rehabilitation. He said, rehabilitation bullshit. Most of these people have never been habilitated in the first place.
Mm.
And I think that's an important thing for us to consider. There are some people, you say, don't care about rehabilitation. They don't know about rehabilitation. They don't know that they matter. They don't know that their lives are worth a diddly, and therefore they are doing what they know how to do in terms of surviving. So they get into a prison situation, and they learn how to cope, as you probably learned how to do in prison. And that becomes, this survival of the fittest kind of ethos. And that's not what we need when we get out into the world.
This is true. And I'm really glad that we have somebody like you that's speaking up for this kind of thing, because it's been going on for too long. And I seriously believe that you may be right, that people never know their self-worth. And this would be a great time for me to shamelessly plug my book, but it's your show, and I really appreciate it. You're doing great work, man. Thank you.
What, before you get off, what were you in prison for, may I ask?
I was in prison for voluntary manslaughter. I came from the system. I grew up in it. It was all I ever knew. And
You grew up in institutions, you mean?
Yes, I did.
Uh-huh.
I did. Children's homes and orphanages, and They actually make it so that you're not prepared to go out into the world in any way, shape, or form. They don't teach you finances. They don't teach you ethics. They don't teach you any of the things that could make a difference in your life.
They don't teach you how to be right.
They actually teach you how to be reliant upon the system totally, so
right.
that you never get out of it.
Right. And what is the book you've written?
The book I've written It Ends With Me, and it's a story from tragedy to success.
It ends with me. Well, bless you for calling. Bless you for writing that book, and bless you for triumphing over this institutionalization syndrome, because it's really a murderous one.
Well, I appreciate your time, and I appreciate all that you do for the cause, man. It's been
Thank
great
you.
Talking to you.
Nice
you have a good day.
All
right.
Thank you, Alan. Lisa in Florida. Actually, before I go into Lisa's question, we have one question that was asked earlier on, but because we had already touched on the acting part of it. Ellen in Missouri wants to know, Mike, do you stay in touch with the other MASH cast characters, and will there ever be another MASH reunion movie?
To answer the second question first, no, there will never be another MASH reunion. but, you know, we've done
that's
that.
A shame.
And no, it's really not. I mean, we loved doing the show, all of us. We felt that it really made the statement it needed to make and felt it was mm-hmm. time to move on when we ended it. But we did one reunion, actually, that I produced, and we had a wonderful time doing it. But there's never going to be another one. There's not, you know, it's just... going too far, trying to get blood out of an onion or whatever the old phrase is. Mm. In terms of staying in touch with my colleagues from the show, absolutely. We are very close. Those of us who live in this Southern California area have dinner together periodically. Alan, who now lives in the East, I see him when I go east or he sees me when he comes back out and we all get together. It was very much a family. It became very much a family one that we cherish to this day.
Well, there you go, Lisa. I hope that answered. I mean, no, that wasn't Lisa. That was Ellen. I hope that answered your question, Ellen. I'm going to ask you, Mike, about, you know, first of all, let me say that having President Obama in office is, at the very least, refreshing after the last two terms under the Bush administration. I always said that it should probably be a prerequisite of the position of President of the United States that the President should be able to speak the English language. And, you know, that's my position, and I'm sticking to it. But I'd like to pick your brain on some of the things that have been going around. One of the questions that Lisa in Florida does have, and her question is, does Mike feel that President Obama can turn things around with the economy? And how does Mike feel about what appears to be Obama's escalation of Afghanistan, which looks like another Vietnam?
Yeah, I am very hopeful about President Obama. I met him before he actually declared to run for the presidency. I found him to be a very, very astute, very intelligent, very thoughtful man who I believe is a very caring human being. I campaigned for him after my candidate fell away, and I was thrilled that he was elected. I think it's a giant step forward for this country that Barack Obama is the president of the United States, both in terms of our standing in the rest of the world and in terms of what it says about us as a people. However, I am not thrilled with some of the things he has done. I think he's been handed an extraordinary pot full of problems that this administration prior created for him. He is ending the war in Iraq, which we know, and that's a good thing. He has this economic snarl to unravel and try and deal with, and some of the things he's done in that respect are very good, I think, but I think not enough, personally. Afghanistan worries me a great deal. I think he's off on the wrong foot in terms of Afghanistan. I'm thinking actually about writing an op-ed piece about when was it that the Taliban attacked us. We are now finding ourselves in a situation of fighting against a force in a civil war in a country, and the question is that the best use of our military might, and I'm not sure it is. The Al-Qaeda are the people that we were theoretically going after, and we seem to have shifted the focus away from Al-Qaeda and toward the Taliban, who I admit are seem to be a pretty horrific bunch, but you know, there are horrific bunches all over the world, and I'm not sure that our job is to lunge into somebody's country because we deem them to be bad folks. So I'm very concerned about what's going on in Afghanistan, and I think the escalation of the war there really does augur for another Iraq, Vietnam, whatever kind of quicksand trap that you want to analogize it to. I hope that he sees the writing on the wall very soon and makes the shift necessary to really do the kind of nation building and put our efforts toward the hearts and minds of the people in that country rather than simply coming in as boot-stomping conquistadors, because I don't think that's a job we do very well.
You know, Mike, I recently heard something, and I haven't been able to substantiate it, really, that there has been some talk about withdrawing a lot of the troops, but in their place, putting mercenaries in, contracted soldiers. That's scary to me, because what that means to me is that we're paying people to go do whatever it takes, and we don't even have to take the blame at that point, because officially, technically, American soldiers would not be there.
Well, I hope that's not true.
I sure hope it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I know they are overtly talking about sending in more troops. If you're going to go, if you're going to fight a battle, we need to be honorable enough to be doing it with our own troops, not with with mercenaries. I hated the fact, and continue to hate the fact, that we used Blackwater and some of these other organizations to the degree we did, not only in Iraq, but in other parts of the world. I've been told that there were Blackwater mercenaries in New Orleans after Katrina, and also in some Latin American countries at the behest of the U.S. So that's very worrisome to me.
Exactly, and it's worrisome to a lot of people, unfortunately. We don't have a lot of time. There's so many things that I want to discuss, so I'm just going to give you some, maybe you can give us some bullet points on your opinions on some of these things. National health care, what do you think?
I think it's an absolutely urgent necessity.
Amen. I agree. Illegal immigration the United States.
Well, I'm not a big fan of the labeling people as illegals. I think people want to come here for a reason. I think the words on the Statue of Liberty really do speak to a basic value in this country. Obviously, you have to control immigration to some degree, but I think the first thing we need to do is find a way to legitimize the millions of people who are undocumented who are here in this country. Make them come rise, you know, above the kind of living in the shadows, and then find ways to work out some sort of rational relationship with the people in particularly Latin America. But I'm not a believer that so-called illegal immigrants are a detriment to our society. I think the immigration has really been the source of the great strength in this society.
I absolutely agree with you again. Iraq.
Well, I do believe
that
Obama...
Are we getting better in Iraq?
Well, no. We need to get out of there. I think the Obama administration is doing the right thing in ratcheting it down, but I would like for them to do it quicker rather than stalling and allowing the thing to play out for another year or whatever they're talking about. If the people of Iraq, as I understand it, if the people of Iraq had their way, the American people, the American soldiers would simply pick up and leave, and I think that's what we ought to do.
Israel-Palestine.
I'm very strongly in support of a two-state solution there. I believe that the Palestinians have gotten a dirty deal for a long time. I think the issue of a safe and secure Israel is one that has reason behind it. Israel does exist. There's no point in pretending it doesn't, nor is there any point in pretending that the Arab world is going to drive it into the ocean. That's simply not going to happen. But I believe that the Israeli government that now exists, the hardline right-wing Israeli governments, have been their own worst enemy and have created situations that are unlivable in Gaza and in large part in the West Bank as well. I think they've got to be able to give up the settlements or trade land in a way that's going to make for a viable Palestinian state, including Gaza, and that's got to be a result of the ongoing effort on the part of the Obama administration through George Mitchell. I think that it is achievable, but I do think that the Israeli government has to be called to account for their failure over the many years to really live up to the things that they've claimed they were going to do.
Certainly. Okay, this is a good one. The President Obama, Professor Gates, Officer Crowley Beer Fest.
Well, you know, I think sitting down and having a beer was not a bad idea. I'm not a beer drinker personally, but the idea of sitting down and bringing these things, these people together, makes for a good model in terms of trying to discuss problems rather than just simply call names. I rather liked President Obama's statement when he said that the police acted stupidly, because I think they did, personally. I think Professor Gates probably did get hot under the collar and probably said a bunch of things that were not professorial. But nonetheless, he was in his own home. He had been targeted for, that's the wrong word, but he'd been subjected to questioning as to who he was. And once it was clear who he was and that he was in his own residence, the police just should have opted out. And the idea that he said some things that got this cop hot under the collar and made the cop want to put cuffs on him and arrest him is just over the top as far as I'm concerned. I think we have to be very, very thoughtful about police relations, particularly with the minorities in our country, because the relationships have not been good and they've not been handled well.
Well, thank you, Mike, for answering so many questions, because obviously, as we said on the break, there is so much work for activism in this country today. There are just innumerable issues that have to be dealt with. What I would like to ask you is, what made this trip of Mule and Man different from your other book tours, Mike?
The fact that the only person I had to talk to was the mule.
Did you get scared on occasion?
No, you know, it was really an extraordinary trip. 9,000 miles in 5 weeks. I saw a tremendous amount of the country. And in every instance, I was able to stop. You know, this is in significant part due to the extraordinary gift that MASH has been in my life. I would go into places I've never been before and meet a crowd of people I've never met before and be embraced and have people interested in meeting me and saying hello and thanking me for whatever their association with the show was, or whatever their association with the organization that was co-sponsoring the event was. And it really was endearing to find that there are people all over this country, you know, forget about red states and blue states, there are people all over this country who really want nothing more than to have an opportunity to have a good life. And we have different ways of going about finding out how to do that. But if you engage people in conversation, even in debate sometimes, as long as it's a respectful debate, you find that we really are all very similar. Color, sex, religion, all those other things aside, we're all very similar as human beings, and we want the same things in life, and we can find ways to live in a manner that's gratifying to us and to others if we maintain a mutually respectful relationship.
Well, that's wonderful. I have one question to ask you before we end the show.
Sure.
And it was a question you kind of asked yourself in the book. Have you found out what you're here for? What am I here for? What are you here for, Mike?
I think we're all here for the same thing. It's to live as thoughtful and as meaningful and as whole and as loving a life as we can possibly do.
Well, there you go, folks, and I agree.
Okay.
This has been wonderful, Mike Farrell. What a wonderful book of Mule and Man. His first book was Just Call Me Mike. You can get this. It's from Oshkosh Books online.
Akashic.
I'm sorry, Akashic
okay.
Books. And just incredible. Just an incredible journey, an incredible journal, a diary of how an activist does what he does. And you do a great job, Mike. Thank you very much for being with us again.
My pleasure.
We wish you a great deal of luck in your future.
Thanks very much, and the same to you.
Thank you. Well, there you are, folks. Next week's guests are Adam Shapiro and Hawaii Da'adaf. They are international, they started with the International Solidarity Movement, and I know both of them and their families, so I'm looking forward to that discussion with them. They were arrested in Israel for going into the Gaza Strip. Thank you very much, and we'll see you all next week. Mike Farrell with of Mule and Man for tonight. Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.